Okay, we have reached day 26. He's coming back, I see. So, we're going to talk more about chapter 17. Yeah. We're still in chapter 17. I'm going to focus on the second section now. Last time we talked about section 2, or section 1. Today we'll talk about section 2. Short homework last Wednesday, and it's due this Wednesday. Remember, next week is just a very short week for this class, right? Because there's the Thanksgiving vacation, so we'll have the Wednesday off next week. So after this week, we have the Monday before Thanksgiving, then we have two class days in December. Maybe two class days after Thanksgiving, and we're done. Looking at chapter 19, if I remember correctly. So the chapter 17 is called Analysis in the 18th Century, i.e. 1700s. And chapter 19 is about kind of sequel analysis in the 19th century, i.e. 1800s. That's where we're going. Now, this section here is focusing on, I guess you could say, multivariable calculus. Last time we talked about a bunch of differential equations. There's always a function of a single variable, y equals f of x or something like that, right? Okay, so focus on multivariable calculus. Originally they didn't think, if you look chronologically, they didn't think about multivariate functions and their derivatives first. First they thought about families of curves. This was the first place where partial derivatives came up. We call them partial derivatives. Remember, they were thinking of differentials, right? The focus here is not going to be on like the Newtonian stuff. The focus is going to be on what some people on the continent were doing. So we're going to be talking about differentials here. So they will consider some differentials. And then there's this concept of the total differential that arises. It's when you get to this stuff, you really see it, you know, it makes sense. You'll think of, you know, families of curves, but it'll also make sense for multivariate functions. Okay. The stuff that came first was, kind of weird type problems to my mind, but I mean things like this. You know, you'd have a family of curves, two variables. Multiples of the logarithm function, right? If you multiply by a number bigger than 1, you get a little steeper, right? You multiply by a number smaller than 1, it'd be a little shallower, right? And Leibniz, for some reason, was interested in the following problem. He said, okay, let's think about a fixed length here. I don't know, pick one of these and you have some fixed length S. Okay? And what Leibniz wants to do is he wants to say, okay, now what would happen if we had the same arc length for all these other curves? The general sense is that for a shallower curve, you'd have to go out a little further, right, to get the same arc length. Right? Imagine doing this for every possible alpha, and they have the same arc length S. Okay, and it would trace out some kind of curve, D. Right? And so, Leibniz, this is in the 1690s, here's this problem, considers this problem. He wants to know about the curve D. So if you could set up a differential equation for that curve, right, then you could know a lot about it, right? Given, say, the arc length S, so if you know at least one point on the curve, that is, then the differential equation would tell you what the curve is. Alright. So you want to think of it, you want to reason with infinitesimals, right? So you imagine these infinitely small but non-zero things, right? You could imagine maybe for some number alpha, we call this curve, this logarithm curve, C alpha. And then if you change it by some very small, change the parameter alpha by some very small amount, d alpha, right, you're going to move to a slightly different curve. But they should be infinitely close together. Use infinitesimal reasoning here. So you might want to know, what is the... What is the slope of the curve D? At some point on here, and find out. So you think about this, and the first idea is, okay, you have this arc length here. Okay, so S is going to have to be an arc length integral, right? We're going to go from, I guess, in this picture, this, say from 1 to some value x right here, okay? and we're going to integrate what? Well, we need an arc length differential. Right? You know the usual thing here. You approximate a little piece of curve, right, is approximately a straight line, right? Okay. Now, they didn't have, an explicit, concept of partial derivatives. They didn't have a fancy name for it. They just said, okay, along each curve, hold the other variable alpha constant, right? So really, on each curve, we write this notation here, see, d sub x to indicate we're taking the differential with respect to x, holding alpha constant. That's the move you make. It's reasonable to consider going along one of these curves, you hold alpha constant. So we're not going to use the product rule on this thing. We're just going to treat alpha as a constant. Okay. And, well, the differential, right, not doing a derivative here. Differential with alpha held constant, right? As you know, the differential, the logarithm is dx over x. Okay, so the idea is infinitesimal dx and infinitesimal d sub xy, and then the hypotenuse of this right triangle should be the infinitesimal ds, except for some error that is infinitely smaller than ds, right? The usual, there's infinitely small stuff, and then there's infinitely smaller errors. Right? So at least at this level, we have the usual Pythagorean theorem relation. Okay, so there we go. Okay, so you're going to have, on the one hand, you'll have a dx squared. On the other hand, you'll have alpha squared dx squared over x squared. Factor out the dx squared. This. Okay, you can take take a square root of that, for example. Get this. And this is supposed to be a constant, okay? As we go from one curve to another. Now, the issue is that as you go from one curve to another, you see that not only does the parameter alpha change, but the x position has to change too, right? With a steeper curve, we'll get the same arc length without having to go as far to the right. Okay. So, in order to figure out what would make the this constant s... Okay, you want to say, okay, ds is zero. Ds is zero should get you a differential equation. But you need to take into account how things are changing here. Right? Both x and alpha change. Okay. And... The idea then is, you can say some things. On one hand, you have this. For a fixed x, right, you can talk about what is the the differential of S, right? How much does S change if approximately if we have a little change in alpha, right? And so what Leibniz sees is that right away, oh hey, you know, we're integrating with respect to X here. That operation commutes with taking the differential with respect to alpha, right? Because they're different variables. So he recognizes this right away. Right, because here you're adding up a bunch of things that happen first as you. What would this mean? It would mean, okay, do this at some value alpha, add up a bunch of tiny dx changes multiplied by this number as you go, as the x values go from 1 to some number x here. And then do it again at with alpha replaced by alpha plus d alpha, right? So it seems it's pretty obvious. Once you look at it, right? I mean, you have a bunch of x values, x0 to xn, right? You're thinking of it as infinitely many, infinitely small things. Or is it xn minus 1? Yeah. Right. You have this at, and then you have this minus the same thing at alpha. So if you're willing to, not worry about what exactly it means to add infinitely many, infinitely small things together. I left up where the dx's go. Got the dx's, put them factored out there, right? Just look, you can just regroup, right? Take this one minus that one. Right? You can regroup. Right, because this thing here, what is this one? On the one hand, we have this thing here. On the other hand, you have the same expression, just grouped differently. When you take the alpha differential, holding x fixed, that says okay. Okay. Value at alpha plus d alpha, but this time you're doing it inside the integral, so you're going to do this at a bunch of x points, right? And that one, that'll be the first one, right? The differential. I guess what's missing there? Yeah, that's it. And then the last one. Now, of course, as usual, you can use rules, to simplify that and drop infinitely smaller terms off. But leaving it unsimplified, right? The concept that Leibniz thought of everything as sums and differences is very clear here. So if you're thinking this way, it's very clear why they should be the same. So this right here is just the same thing I just regroup. You know, here, take the x0 terms and group them together. Then I take the x1 terms and group them together. I take the xn minus 1 terms and group them together. It's the same thing. So there's no problem moving this kind of differential. We would think of it as a partial derivative times a little number d alpha, right? A differential where you're holding the other variable constant. You can move that inside and outside the integral. So that's the key move you need to make. So I claim that this is going to have to be this thing with the d alpha inside is the same as if the d alpha is on the outside. If you can rearrange. So if you're thinking like Leibniz, this, you know, is just obvious algebra. And when we get to the chapter on the 19th century, you know, this is going to be somewhat, it's going to, you know, dealing with, you know, how could you do this without talking about infinite sums of infinitely small things, right? Make a modern epsilon delta proof. Now, it's going to be more work, no doubt about it, but it can be done. And when you see an epsilon delta version of this, it's essentially this idea, just with a little bit of care to show that in the limit of this and the limit of that, it all works out. But essence of the idea is here. And any epsilon delta definitions of the integral and differential concepts that wouldn't make arguments like this work in some form would frankly be a bad definition, right? Because even in our modern limit definitions, the integral is approximated by finite Riemann sums, right? So, I mean, so even if you don't want to think about it, infinitely many, infinitely small things together, the formal modern definition still is a limit that you approximate with a large finite number of small finite things, even if they're not infinitely small or infinitely many. And so this rearranging will happen at some step with any proof. Now, the easier differential, right? You know, if you're Leibniz, you know that integrals just add up a bunch of terms. Taking a difference, you know, just gives you back, you know, what you got, right? This right here. Modulo some infinitely smaller errors is what would happen if you hold alpha constant, right? So in this integral, in both of these integrals here, you're going along, right, a fixed curve. When you get this arc length, you're going along one of these curves, right? The alpha value doesn't change as you go along, right? Okay? All right. So if you put this, so that means you have this concept here. That's easy, right? This here has to equal this thing. That's his method. So Leibniz is looking at it. It was page 602. And he continues the computation. The book writes it slightly differently than I do, but I mean it factors in x squared out of the square root, and it writes a numerator that's square root of x squared over alpha squared. over an x squared plus alpha squared for x. Anyways. Chalk. Now,
if you were thinking about now that curve D, if you had the obvious idea, right? As we said, you know, x and alpha change. So you now you probably can put the picture together and think about curve C alpha plus D alpha. So in this picture, what's going on? There's one x value, right, which are here. And then in this case, the curve D is negative with slope, right? So we go up to here, we have to add some negative number dx, right, to be at the right position. Okay. And so you want to figure out how much does S change, right? I mean, it's not supposed to change at all, right? As you go from, let's call them P and R, okay? As you go from P to R, right, S is supposed to be the same. So the idea is, okay, we want to understand that change. We think of it as two simpler changes. First, there's a change here. We go to some point, we call it Q, right? Where we change X, but we keep alpha constant, right? And then keep the X the same and go up, right? Holding X constant, right? So you're going to have this differential as you change x but leave alpha constant. And you have another change as you go from alpha up to alpha plus d alpha but leave the x alone. Okay. All right. Now the derivative inside the integral is not too hard to do. As long as you know how to differentiate a square root function. The total change is zero. So that gives the desired equation. Right? And here we have something we integrate something x, and we take a derivative with respect to alpha. Remember, the square root, the derivative of the square, we think of it in terms of derivatives, they thought in terms of differentials, right? But in terms of differentials, this would be the relevant rule, right? At various points in the history, in the early history of calculus, people only knew this in terms of power series, but
So like if, anyways, if we do this differential, we have the differential of the thing inside the square root here.
Okay. Which will be...
The thing inside the square root, that's just alpha squared over x squared. Differentiating or with respect to alpha, the 1 doesn't change. And here you have just 2 alpha
over x squared. The x is also not changing. If this, you can maybe simplify that expression a little bit. And on the other hand, you have the x differential, which is
just the integral itself.
Integrand. So, and so you have, you know, actual formulas for these things, and since they add up to zero, you know that this one has to be the opposite of that one. So you have an actual equation, and now you still might not be very satisfied with that. Really, it's an integral equation as it stands, right? And I'm missing something here. Oh, I know what I'm missing. It should be 2 alpha d alpha. Okay. Right? Because the differential of the square. Right? The differential, say, u squared is 2 u du. Right? Okay. So, for example, you could, if you wanted to make it, instead of an integral equation, you want a differential equation, you could do something like this. Take, say, the derivative of, you know, take the derivative or differential of these two things with respect to x, i.e. holding alpha constant, for example. And that would just look like what? On the one hand, you have this thing. Its differential would be basically that, what we did there, right? They don't change, so you just treat it as a constant multiple, you take the differential again. And then here, okay, so with respect to x, you're going to get, that's a negative 2 power of x, right? So you get negative 2 alpha squared dx over x cubed. Just the power rule. Okay, that would be this. And I guess with the negative there becomes a plus. And then here's the other side. Take the x differential of this, and it just undoes the integration, right? Since it's a differential or not a derivative, that dx is still there, right? And you'll notice that you could just then cancel out the common factors of dx there. Right? So for example, if you cancel these out, right, then you've got a d alpha over here and dx over here. Now you can solve for, this is what we would do. For, if you like, you know, think in terms of derivatives, you can solve for dx d alpha or d alpha dx, right? You get a formula. They were thinking in terms of differentials, so they were just left at something like this, you know. They didn't feel the urgency we feel to, you know, put the differentials in fractions like that. Now, there's a guy later, Clairaut, that he does these kinds of problems more systematically. He thinks about kind of the general solutions that you can have, and these ideas here, you know, like total change. So he brings in this concept of the total differential, which corresponds to our modern concept. You teach calculus 3, implicit differentiation, right? You know, it's kind of hard to avoid explaining it without the total differential, right? Sometimes, even though people are not necessarily comfortable with infinitely small things and so on, at the very least, the notation survives and all the methods survive. Even if we have to spend a great deal of time trying to make it rigorous or something, in an introductory course like Calculus 3, you're not going to even bother, really. I mean, because you're not going to prove everything unless it's some honors calculus class. Okay. So a lot of things, as you can see here, they just seem kind of obvious when you interpret things as actual differences and actual sums, and they're not worth giving special names, at least at first. Right, so. Okay, so what's Clairaut doing? There's first, Bernoulli thinks about it for families of curves. Clairaut is for multivariate functions. Right? So. Simple idea. Total change is one plus the other, right? So in general, we could have just written in something like this. Total change in some value
like in our example there, you know, we had 0 was equal to ds. This is would now be the total differential, which now we're giving it a name, you know. So now I'm thinking about more conceptually. So Bernoulli considers, you know, this situation like this. The other, but what Bernoulli adds another thought to it, which is that you notice here, like I took a differential again, right? So here, when you're doing this change, there's kind of two different ways you could have gone. In my picture here, I changed x and then I changed alpha. But I could have gone a different way where I changed alpha and then I changed x. Okay. So this idea, is that it doesn't matter. If you take that idea that it doesn't the total change, it doesn't matter whether you change alpha first or change x first. Because what? Changing x and alpha in either order, right? So you change them separately. Right? Either x then alpha and x, right? It produces the same total change. Now, Clairaut thought about this in terms of multivariate functions, and so his thinking is more like our modern thinking. So you look at it in the calculus book, and like we use, what's the author's name? The calculus book we use here at Tandy, right? I was teaching calculus the other day, right? It's called Clairaut's theorem in our calculus textbook. The formal rigorous version we have, even though it's named after a less rigorous claim of Clairaut's that used infinitesimals, is that if the mixed partials are continuous on an open set, then the two mixed partials are the same. Now, it's named after Clairaut because he figured out first in differential form, right? Which would read like this. Modern rigorous version, you have to add assumptions like the mixed partials are. Now, in modern notation, this would be written like this. Remember in modern, we're always trying to, divide out, by the differentials. But they left the differentials in, which is why our modern way of writing this would be that. Mm-hmm. And this would be the same thing, but with the y and x in the other order. Okay. Now, more interestingly, is the result that if you have a function
you imagine that there's some function that's going to play the role of the dxf and the dyf, okay? So if you have functions p and q, right, like this. So if you can think of the q being that and the p being that, then Clora argues that actually, yes, there is a function f with the corresponding differentials. It would be now the it's not quite the Q in that it's really this should think of this as this differential as being the Q dy and this differential as being the P dx, right? Because they leave them in. Okay. If you might remember seeing something related to this in a differential equations course. Sometimes these will be called exact differential equations. Right? Let me give you an example of this. And I mean, and he gets the F. He actually gives a method of solution. It's not just an abstract existence proof. He shows how to find it. And it's just, it's really the modern way of finding it. I mean, I can walk through an example. You know, what if I said you know, that I want something with where I take the differential holding y constant, and I get let's say 2xy cubed, and if I take the differential with respect to y, right, so I'm holding x constant, then I get, I get 3x squared y squared, okay? There is a solution f, right? It's x squared times y cubed, which you might be able to just see from looking at this, right? But if you didn't know that, I mean, how could you sort of find it, right? The idea is you integrate with respect to one variable and then the other, right? And I'm leaving off the. Gotta remember, they keep the differentials in there. Like, integrate this with respect to x, okay? Okay, you'll get 2x dx, right? The way they think about integrals back then, you know, on the continent, they're thinking about integral as antiderivative, essentially, right? Or antidifferential, right? So this is an integral where y is constant, right? When you do this integral. Okay, so you know x squared is antiderivative of 2x, or they would say, you know, 2x dx is the differential vector. So notice this, but it could be any number, right, plus any constant, right? So make up a name for that constant. How about we call it s of y, right? So there's some constant, right? There's always a constant of integration, right? Okay? But we're doing this for each y, so you have something that depends on y. On the other hand, here, now we take the y differential, okay? Okay. So you've got f, which is this thing, right? We undo the x differentiation, and then we take the y differential that's now holding x constant, and so we get this thing plus
the derivative of s, right? Which in, I guess in our modern notation, you know, we would write it like this, right? And we put a little prime on there, kind of in Newton's style. But if you want to just leave it, you know, more like Benzian style, something like this. Or they probably wouldn't even write the function application stuff. They probably would just write S and write in words that it's a function of Y alone. Okay, so you have... and we left out the, you know, the dy there. Okay, so what do you get here? Well, you get that, now take off the common term, you get 0 is equal to, I guess, they would probably write it, like, if I write it, you know, in terms of the differential or something. So then you get that s is a constant, right? So the general solution is, f is x squared y cubed plus a constant. That's a very simple example. You don't always have to get 0 here, right?
But that's a simple example. That's why I came up with a constant.
And that this is still the method, you know, I would use to solve the differential equation. It's not like I'm showing you an obsolete method there.
Stuff I wrote up here, you know, with the alpha and the x, you know, there's more to the problem because we never got all the way back to y. You know, there's alpha and x slopes, but y as a function of x and alpha is known, so I could have, you know, really wanted that step could have been done. It's just maybe go through the full thing in the interest of time. This thing is on, was it page 602, anyway. Sometimes the formulas get simplified a little differently, but it's equivalent stuff. One photograph. Now, another interesting thing.
We have, you know, equivalence of mixed partials. That's how we think of it in modern terms. Right. Differentiate one thing with the other constant. Then
you have a bunch of people that thought about stuff in terms of double integrals, right? And they were focusing on finding volume and surface area, okay? And those kinds of natural 3D problems. So there are special cases. Some names, you know, in there are Leibniz, Laroque, Lagrange, and there's a general case that Euler handles, and even better, Euler figures out how to do the two-dimensional change of variables formula. Usually our calculus textbook call it the Jacobian, But at least in the two-dimensional case, due to Euler. Okay. Does anybody remember the Jacobian, as it's called? You know how you do a u-substitution for a one or a single integral, but you can do like a rotation or other kinds of changes of variables to go from your xy coordinates to your, you know, r theta polar coordinates or to some weird uv coordinates, right? So he gets the 2D change of variables formula. Another difference is that these guys are generally thinking of double integrals as iterated integrals, right? Like, to find a volume, you find an area function for the slices from holding one coordinate fixed, and then you integrate up those areas of slices, right, times infinitesimal thicknesses. This is what the change of variables formula looks like in modern notation. Euler actually figures it out. The way he figures it out is first he considered a rotation where this factor should be a 1, right? Because if you have a little some rectangle, right? And then you work in a rotated coordinate system, it means you're going to be dealing with infinitesimal rectangles like this. Well, the area of a rectangle should still be length times width, even if it's a slanted rectangle. So what Euler did was he thought hard about the case where this factor here should just be a 1, right? And so when the case where it's a rotation, so he does some algebra. First he does it kind of one variable at a time, right? It's kind of, he works with kind of halfway things. You have x and y in terms of u and v. I think his letters were t and v, but anyways. So first, he'll pick one of these, say like y, figure out a formula for y, or at least a linear approximation. With rotations, you can do it exactly right. Get a formula for y instead of in terms of u and v, get it, say, in terms of v and x, okay? Since you have a system of two equations, x depends on u and v in such a way, y depends on u and v in such a way, you can manipulate the equations and get a different system. So say you still have x depending on u and v in one way, then you make y depend on, say, x and v. You can solve the equations for u and then replace every instance of u with how it depends on, say, x and v. And then, so with an intermediate weird form like that, where y is dependent on x and v, he's able to do a two-step process. And again, I don't have enough time to go through all the details on the board, but he gets essentially this, but he doesn't write partials, right? So I mean, the main thing is if you want to try and translate this kind of stuff, you know. When they write, let's say, if you saw, say, something like this, right? To us, you know, in our modern notation, the P is the U partial, right? What happens when you differentiate with respect to X while holding V constant, right? And the Q is the V partial. What happens when you hold a U constant and change V in the test?
And so with this two-step process, he gets the right formula. He needed to consider rotations to realize that there's kind of a naive thing that I remember trying when I was in college, which is think about this rectangle, think about what its area would be in terms of UV coordinates or something. But that's not the right way to go, because when you're doing this integral, you're cutting up your infinitesimal rectangles a different way. Right? So the naive thing to do is just write out the differential dx like this, then write out a similar differential for dy, and then just literally multiply them together algebraically and see what you get. Right? But what you're getting is the area of this thing expressed in u and v coordinates. That's not what you want. You want the area of this thing. Okay. And this factor here, it corresponds to how much. How much does the transformation stretch out? Right? If say it's a rotation, if it's a rotation, it would just be the exact same length, rotated. But in general, the rotation, the factor could not be one, because maybe what it does to an infinitesimal rectangle dx dy is stretch it out in some way. Right? And so that would make the area factor possibly. Could make the area of this rectangle, depending on how this gets messed up, too big or too small. It can even make it into a parallelogram in the infinitesimal. Now the book, has a nice walkthrough of it. It doesn't require any. All you need is some geometric stuff, which is just given to you at the start. You're given a rotation formula. And you just work through it. It's all algebra. The reasoning is all symbolic. You don't need a picture like I'm suggesting there to help you out. Okay. Now, let me see. Okay. I'm not sure I should have the student evaluations done today, because I'm not sure we have quite enough time left. But I can do them on Wednesday. I'm going to do one thing kind of for fun here. If I can get the projector to come on. Maybe I can't. No, maybe I won't get to do it. Now maybe the computer is off. I don't know if it's going to boot fast enough. Okay, while I'm waiting, maybe I have more time than I thought. I'll tell you a little bit about. Did I get a picture of that? Yes, I did. Thinking of doing. All right. I'll tell you a little bit about Euler's argument here. Okay. So I'm going to write stuff in differential notation. Just think partial derivatives. Derivative of one thing while holding the other variable constant. Okay. So there's different dependencies, right? On the one hand, let's say we have y. Is dependent. If you solve for y in terms of x and v, you have this. You have partial y, partial x, where the other variable is v, and then partial y, partial v, where the other variable held constant is x. And then let's say you also have, that's one total differential. Then let's say you have, in Euler's notation, it's t and v. At least it's the book presents right now. Anyway, let's say we have this one. So in terms of, you're given this, right? You have to do some work to get to that one, right? To change from TV coordinates. In a simple case, you can solve for it. If you do linear, essentially tangent plane approximations, you can still find the P, even if you can't solve the general nonlinear equation. And then other, yes. And then we have dy in terms of the original coordinates, say t dt plus v dv. Okay. So this is where the weird intermediate, right here, this is where the weird intermediate one comes in. You start with this, take partials. You also can. What I was saying with the tangent plane approximations, like if you take these equations, like at any particular point where you plug in particular t and v values, r, s, t, and v are just numbers now, right? You could take this as a system of two linear equations, and you could solve, you could get a solution, right? Where like you solve this system, get dt, and then replace the dt right here with its solution in terms of, say, x and y, or dx and dy, right? And then go back and replace the dx with this. And so you do all the algebra, and you can find the p and q. Okay, so this can be done. So here's what we have now. So on the one hand, you're thinking of, let's just think about the simple case. You forget about the function. Let's say you're just trying to find the area of a region. So you're just focus on the interesting part, the dx dy, okay? All right. So what do we do here? First, if integrate along we have this inner integral here, right? Where you're integrate along so I need to move around. The book writes it this way, but I don't like it that way. I'm going to write it this way. Okay? Because this is the inner integral, okay? As you integrate along here, you're holding x fixed. You're doing a bunch of slices, each at different x values. Right? So if you have a fixed x, your dx dependence is gone. Right? So the dy just becomes qdv. Okay? So you have this. And then now here's the idea here is you have this, and now what you want to do is move things around a little bit here. So now think about move things around like this, okay? What if you did you integrate with respect to x first, okay? So inside here, now you're holding v constant, okay? And use this formula for dx, okay? Mm-hmm. So with no change in V, this just becomes R dt. Okay? So what you end up with is an integral like this. Q R dt dv. Okay? On the other hand, okay, so this QR factor corresponds to this Jacobian over here. Right? Now, on the other hand, though, with this, put in I'm going to use these differential equations over here. Now group this in terms of your dt and your dv terms. Okay? This has to be the capital T, this has to be the capital V. So now you have another system of equations. PR is equal to T, and PS plus Q is equal to V. Do a little bit. Now take, like, say this Q here, solve for that Q, multiply it by R, for example. Right, so you'll have VR minus PSR, but the P and R there are the same as the T. So it's actually the same as this. Okay, and the VR minus ST corresponds to the Jacobian over here. So that's how you got the formula. The reason I have absolute value bars around this instead of just parentheses is it just has to do with the meaning of our modern notation. In the case, in the motivating rotation case that Euler was considering, I mean, of course, it comes out to a positive one. The absolute value bars aren't needed. The reason that could actually matter is because if you have what's called if it's an orientation reversing thing, like it turns a right-handed thing, take a mirror image, make it left-handed. Then this can actually be negative. But if you were actually putting what we would call, in the modern sense, if these had limits of integration, right? So you were actually, say, finding the area or finding the integral of some f function, if you put on the correct limits, then you could make this correct without the absolute value bars. It's just that maybe the limits would look upside down in some places, right? And if you flip the limits back to where you expected them to be, then this would become you get a minus sign, and that's why the absolute value bars handle it, because the way this is usually written is you're integrating over some region. But that's how the modern notation is explained. Now, a region of x, y coordinates, a region of u and v coordinates. That doesn't allow it to be like an oriented region, so to speak. If you're integrating over an interval from 2 to 5, and you write limits of integration, 2 on the bottom, 5 on the top, that gives you one integral. But if I had put 5 on the bottom limit and 2 on the top limit, the integral comes out the opposite number, right? Okay, so
There's the two-dimensional, the same thing could happen if you think of these as iterated integrals.
Okay?
And so if you put the right limits on, so even though they might look upside down sometimes, right, with two on top, five on the bottom, stuff, if you put the limits on the right way, then you don't need this absolute value bar here. The absolute value bar here is needed if you always choose, you know, to put the two on the bottom and the five on the top, so to speak. If your region is determined by two curves, you know, bottom curve and top curve or something, right? Okay. So there's not really a problem with having the no absolute value bars there. You just have to be careful about the limits of integration. But, yeah. I'm going to quit now. Tell you the fun thing next time.
A little bit of trivia. We'll get to it on Wednesday.